Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we help you think about the past in different ways. Now, we're doing a bit of an off-the-cuff bonus episode today, aren't we, James?
We are indeed, Sam.
Because we've got the anniversary of the Normandy invasions, D-Day, coming up tomorrow. So we decided we would stop everything and do a special Unexpected History bonus.
For the 6th of June.
For the 6th of June.
2019.
That's right.
75th anniversary of D-Day.
Yeah, so this may not be as necessarily polished, even though we do ramble a lot, as normal. But what we wanted to do is to... there's going to be a lot of stuff in the press and in the media about the Normandy invasions, about D-Day. And I think James and I just wanted to fly a flag for Unexpected and say, stop and wait and make sure that you are aware of all of the different ways that you might be able to think about Normandy and about D-Day, because there are loads of different routes into this fascinating topic, and it may well be that you end up hearing the same things over and over again. So that's really our purpose for the day, isn't it? We're going to sort of explode.
It is. I have a sort of I have a lump in my throat as well.
Yeah, you said when I came around, you felt a bit teary.
Yes, a bit teary, and I felt that we shouldn't do our normal sort of flippant, humorous beginning, because I think this is something that is... that's incredibly important for historians to think about. And I think there are lots of different ways to get into it, as you said, but one of the most important ways to start thinking about it is about remembering.
Yeah.
So it's about memory, and we're witnessing the leaders from the Allied powers today in Portsmouth, and tomorrow they're going to be in Normandy. And they're remembering those brave men and women who lost their lives on those days.
Mm. So it's a part of a process of remembering, isn't
yeah.
it? And there are multiple layers to that. Here's a list of what I think Normandy's about.
Okay.
I think it's about the present, not the past.
Yes.
I think it's about layers of history. I think it's about the Iraq War.
Yeah,
I think it's
definitely.
About churches, Freudian slips, foreign policy, the Watergate affair, Cold War and Vietnam.
For me, it's about photographs, pockets, secrets, Slapton Sands,
oh yes,
of all things, weird weapons and deception, and funnies.
Funnies.
I'll come to you about...
I like a funny.
Hobart's funnies. Oh. So it's about all those ingenious contraptions that were designed to make sure that the troops could actually land on the beaches in Normandy, and then all sorts of wonderful things that, you know, got rid of mines and tanks could go over and they could bridge water and all sorts of stuff, all sorts of clever stuff.
I'm going to start.
Go on then.
Because I've come across something which really, really made me think about D-Day in a completely different way. And it's an article from 2012 called The Many Meanings of D-Day by someone called Kate Delaney. And what Kate Delaney has done is a stroke of genius. Kate Delaney has looked at all of the previous celebrations and anniversaries of D-Day, and has studied what people have said at them, what the leaders of the world have said at them.
Yep.
And it's amazingly informative and interesting.
Yep.
So just to make it clear that the first anniversary for D-Day was the year after it. It was in 1945, June 1945, when the troops had their first anniversary. Oh, and actually, before we start that, it's worth saying what else was going on at the time, because it's not just about attacking northern France. So Rome is liberated at exactly the same time. So news of Allied troops going into Rome and conquering Italy happens at the same time that news of the launch of the Normandy attacks also happens. So the Allies are on tenterhooks. It's going well in one area and they want it to go well.
Rome was elsewhere. A mistake, apparently. They should have gone elsewhere. Well, freed up the peninsula instead, but they were after the glory of Rome.
It worked in terms of how it was reported. I'll tell you that much. So here are some really wonderful things. So the fifth anniversary, 1949, it's celebrated with a French naval guard, a local bugle corps, and an honour guard from an American Legion post in Paris. They take part. A pair of young girls from the surrounding villages place wreaths on the beach, and the U.S. Air Force flying fortresses pass over, firing rockets. Not sure about that, and dropping flowers. Now, when it gets to the 1950s, it starts to get really interesting. So we're in the midst of the Cold War, and the Marshall Plan is being enacted by the Americans. And this is their plan to help rebuild Europe after the war. So they're investing something like $12 billion, which is nearly $100 billion in modern money. And what we have here is we have Barry Bingham, who's head of the Marshall Plan mission in France. He uses the occasion of the D-Day celebrations to praise France's post-war recovery efforts, and therefore to give themselves, the Americans themselves, a pat on the back for helping France do that. 1952, there are more celebrations, and now we're in the middle of the Korean War, and the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces speaks at the D-Day celebrations, and he talks about a new and more fearful totalitarianism. So they're using the beaches of D-Day like a stage to deal with the issues of what they're going on here. And he warns that the communist powers... So he's speaking directly to the communist powers from the beach in northern France, not to underestimate our resolve to live as free men in our own territories. We'll gather the strength we've pledged to one another and set it before our people and our lands as a protective shield until reason, backed by strength, halts further aggression. And he says here, the last time I came here, so he was part of the original attack, I came as one of thousands to wage war. This time I come to wage peace. So we've got 1952, D-Day, they're worried about communism, and he's using it to preach peace. Now, 1954, Eisenhower's getting... We're really in the midst of the Cold War now, and Eisenhower speaks and talks about his profound regret that the members of the Grand Alliance have not maintained in time of peace the spirit of that wartime union. My pleasant association with the outstanding Soviet leader, Marshal Zhukov, and the victorious meeting at the Elbe of the armies of the East and the West. So again, he's using it to comment very negatively on what the Russians are up to in the 1950s. Now, bear with me, because this carries on and gets a little even more interesting. Mm-hmm. So in the 80s, Reagan, he's not very interested in the 82 one, and Nancy actually speaks, and she says, if my husband were here today, he would tell you how deeply he feels the responsibilities of peace and freedom. He would tell you how he can best ensure that other young men on other beaches and other fields will not have to die. And I think he would tell you of his ideas for nuclear peace. So in the 80s, there's a big public press issue to do with cruise missiles in America.
Yep.
And what's going on. And they're putting cruise missiles on naval ships in the 80s. So it's all within the frame of nuclear disarmament. And Reagan then gives this extraordinary speech in 84. So he didn't do it in 82.
But it's 40th anniversary, isn't it?
Yes. Yep. And he uses that to relaunch his presidential campaign. So he's particularly targets D-Day to do that. And he talks about the alliance and how important it is. And he celebrates very clearly all of the different the people in the different countries who fought. And then he addresses the Russians, and he's very two-faced about this. He says that on the one hand, they were there to help with the success of the Second World War, and the other, look at what was happening now in the 80s in politics there. Now, this one also is really interesting, because Helmut Kohl, he's not invited. And it does raise the question of who gets to be invited to them. So the 1994 celebrations, the 50th one, by now, Germany's reunited. There is no East West Germany. Czechoslovakia has split up and the Soviet Union doesn't exist. So, for the first time, you've got the leaders of Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia here. So it's a visible symbol of the changing structure of Europe. Again, it all happens on the stage of the beach.
So that's Clinton.
In Northern
50 years, is it?
This is Clinton, yeah. And now Clinton, the interesting thing about Clinton is there's now a generational shift. So he's born after the war. He has no first-hand memories or experiences of the war at all. And his speech is all about being the children of the sacrifice. And it all goes down very well. Now, it then gets more and more and more complicated. So 2004, we got the war of Iraq. There's great tension between France and Germany and who is supported. Bush goes, but this is for the first time that the Russians attend. So Putin arrives and also Gerhard Schroeder is there. Which is really important. And so, again, you've got this changing European dynamics all happening on the beach of northern France. Then the 65th anniversary is 2009. Again, we've got another generational shift. And Obama speaks for the first time. He doesn't talk about the people just on the beach. He talks about all of the people in the background, all the people working in the factories. It's a really interesting way that Obama thinks. And one of the things I particularly loved about this is that Gordon Brown was then prime minister, and they go and inspect Omaha Beach, which is where the Americans landed, and Gordon Brown gets it wrong and calls it Obama Beach.
God. Slip of the tongue, I'm sure.
Horrendous. Horrendous slip.
Well, caught up in the sort of magnetism of Barack Obama, I imagine.
So the point is, if you look at the preceding D-Day celebrations, so they're happening tomorrow, they're happening today, they've been happening since 1945. And if you look at what's happening, it helps you understand the present. And I think that's really interesting. And I'm fascinated to see what's actually going to happen now with Brexit, because I'm sure some European tensions will be visible.
Yeah, well, not only Brexit, but also Trump. You know, and America First is isolationist. If you contrast those ideas with, say, the speech of Reagan. You know, Reagan speaks out against isolationism. So, you know, for him, 40 years on, he was looking back to the role that America had played. And in some ways, America had come in too late. He says, well, the speech which was written for him, of course, by Peggy Noonan, a speechwriter, "We in America have learned bitter lessons from two world wars. It is better to be here, ready to protect the peace, than to take blind shelter across the sea, rushing to respond only after freedom is lost. We've learned that isolationism never was, never will be an acceptable response to tyrannical governments with an expansionist intent." It was very different from, you know, what we might expect from Trump tomorrow. Yeah. But the other way of looking at it is also thinking about it in terms of the generations that fought in the conflict. And, you know, the men and women that you've got in Portsmouth and over in Normandy over the next couple of days must be in their 90s. So in some ways, they're celebrating this every 5 and 10 years. So in some ways, what we're seeing is the end of an era, the end of people who are able to be involved in the commemorations who actually fought in it. And I think this is probably the last time. And I think, which leads me on to what I was going to talk about. And this is something that's very dear to histories of the unexpected. And it's thinking about how you reconstruct the history and the experiences of people who've been through the wars. When we did our little podcast on World War II, because we've just written a short book called The Unexpected History of World War II, we talked about some of the oral histories. And I think what's amazing for D-Day is the range of voices that still survive. And I was just reading the newspaper, following The Guardian today, and looking at Emmanuel Macron, the French president, and the speech that he gave in Portsmouth. And he quotes there a young resistance fighter called Henri Fertet, who was executed at just 16 years old, and we have surviving a letter from him to his parents. "My dear parents, I'm going to die for my country. I want France to be free and the French to be happy. The soldiers are coming to get me. I must hurry. My handwriting may look wobbly, but it's just because I'm using a small pencil. I'm not afraid of death. My conscience is completely clear. 1,000 kisses. Long live France. And it's not just written records like that. We've got photographic evidence, but also there have been wonderful projects that have been capturing the oral testimony of people that have that experienced it. And for our book, we relied quite a lot on some of the big public oral history projects that were produced. And there's a wonderful BBC archive called Voices of D-Day, which captures not just the sort of the Allied response, but there's a German response as well. So the Axis powers, there are men, there are women. There's a French resistance fighter who celebrates his 18th birthday. And I just wanted to sort of share a couple of these with our listeners, just to sort of give a range of perspectives on this. And one of the ones that struck me most was an individual called Bob Littler, who was 19 on D-Day, and he's a corporal in the 2nd Battalion of the King's Shropshire Light Infantry. And he gives this, he records his memories, and one of the things that was most poignant was the build-up to D-Day. And of course, they didn't know when it was going to be, but there's a sense that it's going to happen over the summer of 44. And he goes home to visit his father, and his father takes him up into the hills. And I just want to read you this little extract here. One of the later, we're getting leave practically every other weekend at this time. Make the most of it, chaps, you know. It's obviously got to be done this summer sort of thing while the weather's suitable. That was percolating down to us. We knew that. And I went home with my dad and he was getting his bit of petrol. He took me to the top of one of the hills in Herefordshire where you could see a panorama. It was brilliant. Well, you've got it. Here was brilliant. And he said, well, this is what it's all about, son. See all the Jerrys, he said, and we don't want them here, do we? Because he'd been in the 14 to 18 war, got gassed in it. He said, this is why we're trying to do this, and it's worth it, isn't it, when you see this? And I agreed, of course. I was about 19 and a bit then, 19 and a quarter, I suppose. I thought on the same lines. There was no argument about it. And being in the wonderful countryside in Herefordshire, it is a moral booster. A moral booster rather than morale booster. It is what it's all about. It is what you want forever rather than a jackboot stamping on you, I think. Yes, you couldn't do anything else but agree. Another perspective is a woman's perspective and the way that women were involved in D-Day. And there's another great voice that survives, a woman called Ginge Thomas, who was employed as a shorthand writer to Lieutenant General Frederick Morgan, who's one of the chief of staff to the Supreme Allied Commander in London. She says that he's basically a workaholic. And from her account, you can basically see all the preparations that are taking place for D-Day, which is absolutely extraordinary. All the planning that went into choreographing this Operation Overlord, as it was called. And one of the things that struck me here was the way in which they were trying to piece together the terrain and the geographical landscape of northern France when they were arriving. And she says, I remember an appeal going out to the public for any information that they thought might be of help to the planners, like picture postcards, Michelin guides, mm-hmm. the type of thing, maps, anything, so that they could plan the beachheads the other side. And I remember a flood of stuff coming in. I remember the rooms with the postcards and things on the wall. Such a flood of stuff came in. And obviously, out of a vast amount of stuff, there was bound to be a fair bit that was going to be of value and help. There's also such a poignant, really touching account of they're worried about whether the weather is going to be okay for the invasion, because basically what they've got to do is line up the stars with the sea, so there's a certain gap that they need to get so that everything aligns, and the weather's fine so that they can land. Otherwise, they're going to have to wait a couple of weeks. So it's very tense, you know, knowing whether they're actually going to be able to go. And there's the eve of D-Day, she and the people she's with on the military base can't sleep. And so they wake up in the middle of the night and they go to the local chapel that's on the base and basically pray. you know, and spend the whole night kind of in prayer. The final thing that I want to talk about, because I think this brings a different perspective, is a German perspective. So a Franz Gockel, who 18 years old on D-Day, and he was stationed at Resistance Post 62 on the beach of Colville-sur-Mer, which is what the Americans codenamed Omaha rather than Obama beach by the landing by the landing forces. And his is one of the best accounts that I've got, that I've come across, that I've got, that I've read, of the forces coming in and landing on the beach and how that actually appeared to the Germans who were defending
That's great. I've their never, territory. Never read one of those.
On D-Day, we were shocked. And I, as well as the others, we were defending ourselves. We wanted to survive. They were not our enemy. We did not know them. And we had no chance to say yes or no to what was happening. And it goes on. The opponent wanted to defeat us, as it was called in those days, and we did our best in order to repel the opponent. And we did not think about the individual human being. When the landing troops arrived, we said that on every single boat there were more soldiers than in our entire bay of 6 kilometres. Each ship had a few hundred, and we had about 300 to 400. Each resistance post had 20 to 25, and each boat was spitting out 30, 50, 100. In the beginning, our artillery, which was already trained at the beach, was showing us the aim, and the artillery did manage to bring the attack to a stop in the first 2 or 3 hours. He then goes on to describe how he was wounded, and he basically tries to sort of retreat. He doesn't describe it as retreat, but to sort of go and get medical help, because retreat isn't something that the Germans were sort of drilled in doing. They were basically there to defend until the death. But then there's a passage where he says, I was standing there until the ships were close to the beach, about 500 to 600 metres away. And just before they were going to land, they were shooting like a rolling wall of fire. And this wall of fire started with the barriers on the beach. The barriers were made of stems of trees, which partly had telemines, which were shot to pieces so that the landing boats could get through more easily. And we had put those stems of trees there with the mines. We believed if they come, they will not only come during a high tide. They will only come during a high tide. And now they were coming with a low tide. This was a surprise to us. Partly they were torn to pieces and partly they were burning. But there were still a few which were standing. This is the trees. Because to shoot a single tree to pieces, you had to hit it precisely. At high tide, there was a bigger landing boat which had come after all the small ones. They only had 15 to 20 men. But this large one, which landed right in front of us, had about 200 to 300 men, and they had their exit on both sides and stood bunched up. And one comrade, who was 50 metres in front of me, and he came crawling into my bunker and shouted, Franz, beware, they are coming. Now you have to defend yourself. And this is what we both did. So from this, you get such a sort of a sense of the battle from all perspectives.
Yeah.
From operational command to somebody who's you know, talking to his father and preparing himself mentally, to somebody who is trying to repel the invading force.
The postcards were good, aren't they? They're really interesting.
Yes.
So that woman's description of things, and that I love that when you're sitting at home and minding your own business, and you suddenly realise that a little postcard on the wall that was sent to you from Normandy several years before might be the key to someone's safety.
Yes. Absolutely.
The praying side of it was also interesting. Have you come across any other descriptions of people praying? Because I've come across loads.
Oh, share them.
Churches. D-Day's all about churches.
Right, go on then.
You know that?
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
I it suddenly made a lot of sense to me. There are a couple in Normandy where significant things happened on D-Day, and they've been the memory of what happened in or on that church has remained and continued. So you've got one in the small hamlet of Saint-Mère-Église, where it's a very well-known incident. It's a paratrooper, John Steele, of the 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment, sorry. He gets caught in the spire of the town church and is stuck there with the fighting going on below him. And he has to pretend that he's dead because the Germans are in the town. Yep. He is stuck on the church. So he pretends he's dead until someone realises he's not dead. And he's taken down, and held captive. And that's I've seen photographs now of that. There's a recreation of the parachute around the steeple of this church. Hmm. There's another one in Angouville-au-Plain, which is a church which was used by U.S. Army medics. So once they'd taken the area, medics set up in the church to treat both Germans and British and French and American soldiers, and the pews were used as beds, and they still carry blood stains from when they were operating on them
to this day.
Gosh. So you can go and see them. Interestingly, the medics refused any soldiers to have any weapons inside the church, which was something which was heeded and agreed from both sides. Now, one of the medics, Robert Wright, said that he wanted to be buried at that particular church. So profoundly affected was he by his experience of being in that church in D-Day that he asked for his ashes to be buried there. But it turned out to be impossible. And the only way they could do it was to smuggle his ashes into France and then do it on the sly. So there's a headstone there which reads R-E-W, which is Robert Wright's initials. Mm. Now, see, on the one hand, you've got this saving of lives, and you've got the fighting going on in the churches of northern France. But what I found completely staggering is what was going on in New York at exactly the same time. So there's a collection of photographs which were taken on D-Day in churches in New York, and they're wonderful. Now, here are a few of them. I'm going to flick through here.
These are people praying for the troops.
Praying for the troops on D-Day. Can you describe a couple of those for me, James? A few people scattered around in a fairly grand-looking building.
Yeah, so this is a church with pews. Don't know whether it's Episcopalian or Catholic church.
Not sure. This one's definitely Catholic.
Yeah.
So that one, that's the Saint Vincent de Paul's church in Chelsea, so the west side of Manhattan.
Yeah.
And it's a particularly interesting church, this. I've been looking into this. So it's a church. They're not just randomly having photographs taken in this church. This is a church which serves the French-speaking community in New York. So not just exiles from France itself, but French-speaking community from all over the world, principally from West Africa.
So that woman there is on her knees praying in a chapel.
She's playing. She's
having lit an intercessory candle.
That's right. And there are other examples of these. Now, this church, the Saint Vincent de Paul, is really interesting because it was the building which was the location of Edith Piaf's wedding in 1952. But would you like to look at it now? It's an amazing building.
Gosh, that's quite striking, isn't it?
Fully boarded up.
Yes.
It's shut.
Shut now.
Yeah, it's completely closed. It is not used as a church anymore. And this used to be the beating heart of France in Manhattan.
Right.
And it is now empty. It has been completely...
Do we know why it's empty?
Abandoned. Not off the top of my head, but there were decisions not to carry on.
Right.
And there was a real fight to keep it going, but it was ignored by... I'm not entirely sure who it was, some part of the New York bureaucracy claimed that the existing facade, it's neoclassical, replaced the original Romanesque Revival facade in 1939, was designed by a little-known architect and lacked architectural distinction. Right. That's the reason.
So it's closed down for that rather than funding? Or
I mean, it's unbelievably small-minded.
Yeah.
Because, OK, you have layers of history. It may not be the original church, but it's still massively significant. And the fact that it's a location of history passing, we've got all these photographs of people praying in there. We know that Edith Piaf got married, but whatever. Looking at it from D-Day point of view, this was a really significant location of history and what was going on in America at the time. And it's been closed down, which I think is a tragedy.
Yes.
Quite
telling also about religion is... To link us back to the speeches that you were talking about, is George W. Bush's speech on, I think it's 2004, which is 60 years, the 60-year anniversary. And one of the things that he emphasises there is the role of religion in the American troops that landed, that along all the other stuff that they were carrying, they found Bibles on them. So carrying those sort of personal prayer books.
Well, just before we move too far away from what was happening in New York, so Roosevelt addresses the public directly and tells them what's been going on, and the address itself is conceived in the form of a prayer. And what he does is he calls on the entire American people to continue their prayers in the coming days. He says, "Many people have heard that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer, but because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that all our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts." And elsewhere I found proof that the reaction of many Americans was, in fact, to attend religious services. So the fact that these photographs exist of all of these churches and chapels in Manhattan on D-Day is evidence of an unusual phenomenon. He hasn't just wandered into a church. There are normally people there praying. There are an unusually large amount of people in the churches. So you've got the fighting in and around the churches of Normandy, and then everyone, hands together, eyes uplifted in America, and they're kind of joined that way. I thought that was really interesting.
Very good. Very good. Well found.
Thank you.
For me, D-Day is about pockets. And we've done a podcast on pockets. We've written a chapter on pockets in our World War II book. And this is about the invention of the cargo pocket, which has a very interesting history on D-Day. The 1930s...
The cargo pocket being a pocket on the bag of your...
You know, like cargo pants, in the American sense, pants meaning trousers, cargo pants have big pockets that you put stuff in, largely munitions and things. But in the 1930s, there was a revolution in army uniforms, and it started in the British Army. And in 1938, there's a new type of uniform, widely known as battle dress or number five uniform, that was very practical and functional and packed full of pockets. The trousers had a large map pocket. There was a pocket in the left knee and the right upper hip. There was a new pattern battle dress introduced in 1942 as well, which included two inside pockets in the shirt, reduced to a single inside pocket in later variations. Troops in parachute and glider units were also issued special trousers with two pockets. This transfers to the American Army as well. And the US airborne divisions of paratroopers, where in 1942, the commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, one Major William P. Yarborough, oversaw the development of a special new uniform. So basically what they were looking at was really suitable kit that would allow paratroopers to jump. So they needed comfortable boots and land safely, and also pockets all over them so that they could carry stuff, because they were literally carrying over £100 worth of stuff. Do you want to know what the equipment issued to US paratroopers included?
Yes, I do, James.
It included 3K rations of daily combat food, as well as an extra in the jump trousers, a raincoat, 2D rations, or emergency chocolate bars, with 3 more inside the jacket, a flashlight with batteries, a bandolier of 30.06 ammunition, as well as 2 on the chest, a shaving and toiletry kit, sewing kit, carton of cigarettes, and 2 60mm mortar rounds.
And I assume that that is an official
list.
As we know, as good historians, what actually happens is usually wildly different.
Exactly. And so what they did, because they had so much of this stuff...
They've loaded more in there, I reckon.
But there are records of them as they're going to the aircraft, throwing cartons of cigarettes and useless kit and coins that they don't need out to the crowds that are following them. But on D-Day, they're basically flying over France. They're being dropped. Their pockets are just stuffed with everything that, with the force of the slipstream, the strong slipstream, as they come down, the pockets split open. And so apparently, on the first day, on D-Day, the beaches of Normandy are just strewn with all this
cigarettes
stuff
and chocolate. It was raining fags and chocolate.
If somebody could get in touch to say whether this is actually authentic or not, we would be very, very grateful.
Yeah, but it does raise a couple of interesting questions. And the first is what you keep in your pockets is yes. something that we've become slightly obsessed with
it
doing
is.
This ridiculous podcast. And we please listen to our podcast on pockets. It's yes. one of the most interesting ones I think we've done.
And read Rebecca Unsworth's brilliant article on the history of pockets.
Yeah. And when you're thinking about D-Day, think about all the personal little things that people had, the little knick-knacks that associated them home, good luck charms.
Yep.
That's all part of it as well, which yes. is... Sorry, which has a very long history.
Yes.
Well, that was wonderful.
It was. I've got more. Do you have more?
I haven't got any more.
I have more. So it's all about decoys and inventions as well.
Yeah.
So one of the things that the Allied powers wanted to do was basically disguise the fact that they were going to invade in Normandy.
Yes.
And so they wanted to make the Axis powers, the Germans, think that they were going to land in Calais.
Yep.
And so have you come across those inflatable tanks that were put on the beaches? There's an example of one here, a brilliant little book that was produced by the Imperial War Museum by Peter Taylor called Weird War II, which I recommend to you all. You've got an example of the tanks there. But also as decoys, as the paratroopers were coming down, they also sent down decoy paratroopers. So they sent down about 500
dummies
that would be in other places, that would land in other places and take the Germans' attention off the actual paratroopers that were landing.
There's a lot of sleight of hand in the Second World War.
Yes.
And I wonder, and there's a kind of continuing
zebra ships
interest in it.
Yes.
And I wonder why. Have you given that any thought? Why are people interested in it? What is it about trickery? Is it that people are so interested in?
I don't know. It's unusual, isn't it? And it combines.
It kind of isn't. I mean, if you look at the history of warfare, it's fundamentally not. So, I don't think people are surprised.
It's unusual
by it.
To me. I'm surprised by it. When you first showed me those zebra ships, I'd never seen anything like that before.
He's talking about dazzle camouflage, the First World War.
Which was extraordinary, and that's used in the Second World War as well.
Mm.
So I don't know. It's a sort of a fascination with weaponry, and also things that are sort of
maybe it's a reaction to that. So you have weaponry,
yeah.
and then you have the opposite of weaponry, which is actually shadows pretending
yes.
to be troops
yes.
or dummy troops.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's literally the opposite of that, which is why perhaps it's so powerful if you put the two of them together. So on the one hand, you're talking about rockets being launched from Germany and landing on London.
Yes.
And on the other hand, you're talking about literal shadows, cutouts of people,
yes.
So they appear like they do on airfields or dropping dummies out of
yep.
airplanes,
yep.
and it's that contrast which grabs people's attention.
Yes,
hmm.
But there were also many technological innovations. In particular, Hobart's Funnies, which were designed by Major General Percy Hobart, who's a commander, and what he did was adapt various sort of standard tanks for various uses. I mean, have a look at some of these pictures here. A Churchill tank with a bobbin on it, which is basically a large bobbin. And what it would do, it was basically
a small bobbin, a track.
So they would lay out tracks so that other vehicles could come over it. There was another one adapted so that it could fit a large mortar. There were crocodile flame-throwing tanks. So one of the guns was replaced with a flamethrower. Sherman tanks with that were used to climb up escarpments. There were other things that sort of came along, and they had, you know how a tank has the sort of the top to it. What's the toppy bit called? The turret. The turret was gone, and then there were two arms that came out each side, and it would form into a bridge. So all kinds of things like that. There was another tank with that was equipped with chains that would whip around and that they would explode all the mines around.
So what's interesting about that, I suppose, is that you've got a active interest in innovation.
Yes.
In the middle of one of the most important military operations in history.
Yes.
Which is very unusual.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Well, it is
I mean, partly...
People try stuff out, but they won't necessarily try it out when actually...
It's partly because a couple of years earlier, when they tried to land in Dieppe, an amphibious landing, it failed because they didn't have the craft that would enable them to actually, you know, go up the beaches. So there's a lot of practice. And in fact, very near us, in Slapton Sands, which is just outside of... very near where we are, South Devon, near Dartmouth, where you've got a sort of a beach very similar to the Omaha beach,
Obama beach,
it's got water, still water behind it.
Oh yes,
so it's got a sort of lake behind it. So the Americans practiced their D-Day landings on that, and this happened in, I think, about April 28th of April 1944, and in fact they were attacked by German high-speed patrol boats, and several hundred were killed. And they hushed this up because they didn't want the Axis powers to know that they were going to launch an attack in Normandy.
Well, I think the important thing to remember is that, well, it's easy to forget the sort of lens of what's happening here, and that no one had ever tried to do anything on this scale in this location before. And
no,
it's not only impressive that it happened and they achieved it, but they did it at all, you know, full stop. And there was a constant fear of failure. So don't forget that it very nearly could not have worked.
Well,
it could go wrong.
The Americans nearly failed.
And the panic about the innovations actually really made me think. It's to do with insecurity and having faith, not having faith. What do we need to do? Literally everything we can to get that edge to defeat the enemy.
Yep.
So a great deal of uncertainty there.
Excellent.
That, I hope, has exploded this subject a little in your minds, and will help you follow your own little rabbit hole of research.
So D-Day is about voices, memory, churches, pockets, dummies,
The Watergate affair, the Cold War, Vietnam, cruise missiles, and it's all about the present. Be very aware of the way you're thinking about a D-Day is completely coloured by the world that you live in and the experience you have and the knowledge that you already have. And because of that, it's unique. And so celebrate it. And let us know about it, what particular aspects you're interested in. Now, I very much hope you've enjoyed this. I've really enjoyed this.
I like
doing an anniversary thing. Do get in touch with me. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis.
And I'm at James Daybell. And you can follow Histories of the Unexpected podcast on at Unexpected Pod.
You've got historiesoftheunexpected.com for all of our books, all of our live shows. And one last final message: James and I have recently launched a Patreon account. You can find us at patreon.com/historiesoftheunexpected. Any financial help you could offer us will keep the mics on so that we can spend our time preparing for these, we could spend our time recording for them, we can pay for the equipment, and we can pay for people to edit them and get them uploaded and under your noses and in your ears and in your brains. We're on a bit of a mission to change the way that people think about the past, and it's a serious mission, and we cannot do it without your help. So anything you can offer, just $2 a month, will make all the difference.
Yes, please.
Thank you so much, guys. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.